come to our Bible study, Psalm 145. Start with our summary statement. Psalm 145 praises God for his covenant faithfulness. That will bring his kingdom to the earth. I'll go over that one more time. Psalm 145 praises God for his covenant faithfulness that will bring his kingdom to the earth. Outline for the psalm, simple outline, being three parts. Verses 1 to 7, God's greatness. Verses 8 to 14, God's glory. Verses 15 to 21, God's goodness. You like that, did you? I don't normally do a whole lot of alliterations, but it is an acrostic psalm, so I thought, hey, we'll go with a theme here. So I'll go over that outline again. Verses 1 to 7, God's greatness. Verses 8 to 14, God's glory. Verses 15 to 21, God's goodness. All right, so we'll go to our observations. So Psalm 145 was written by David. You can see the superscription there, David's Psalm of Praise. So it is ascribed to him in the superscription. This is actually the last psalm that has a superscription. There's no musical direction that is given in the psalm. We do have the word for praise that's used in the heading, which essentially indicates a song of praise or a hymn of praise. And I think there's maybe one other reference to singing, the singing of praise in the text, but nothing further. There's no occasion that is given in the heading or the text of the psalm, but the psalm as a whole envisions the future kingdom when all of creation praises the king. So certainly a forward-looking psalm envisioning something that has not as yet occurred. So to categorize this psalm is a praise psalm, and that's actually in the very heading of the psalm, a David's Psalm of Praise. And this is the only psalm that has this word praise in the heading, the superscription of the psalm. Now, when you think about a praise psalm and you think about the typical conventions of a praise psalm, we can see that it certainly does meet it. You have a vow or commitment to praise. You have an expression of ongoing, unending praise. You have a catalog of praiseworthy acts and attributes, and you have a concluding commitment to praise. And so certainly fills out well in that particular psalm type. To think about sort of the minor categories of the psalm, one, it is a kingly or a royal psalm. It does mention king and kingdom in this psalm. And another minor category would be that of prophetic predictive. Again, as the psalm looks forward to a future scene that has not as yet taken place. So Psalm 145 does connect with the David group of psalms. It's the last of this final David group of psalms, Psalm 138 to Psalm 145. So it's the last of this final group of David psalms, and it does connect. And what we've seen, really, which sort of started in 144, the last one we looked at, is there's sort of a turn. And so you had certain themes in these psalms, in this final David group. And by the time you get to these last two psalms, and now this last one, what you get really is an ultimate resolution. It's an ultimate fulfillment of the themes that occurred, the themes of lament and trouble and distress and all of those things, the threat of enemies and all of those things, persecution and such that we saw reference to. Really, we see all that turned around. All of that is resolved. All of that is answered, and essentially, you just have universal praise in this particular psalm. So it does connect with them. But also, if you think about this David group, and then you go back to the psalm right before it, which would be Psalm 137. Psalm 137 lamented the exile and was looking for a redeemer. And we come through this David group of psalms, and you get to 144 and 145, and we can see clearly that redeemer is the Davidic king who brings God's kingdom to the earth. And so it sort of functions like an answer or what these psalms were building to. And then also, when we think about connections, we'd have to look a little bit forward because it does set the stage very well for the final psalms that end this entire collection of psalms. And if you're familiar at all with them, you know that these final psalms are all just exultant praise psalms and universal praise and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of connection forward as well in this with this psalm. Now, the poetic features of Psalm 145, you do get some imagery, some poetic type expression. You get in the psalm, when you look at it, you get some of these spatial type of references, which one of the ways is getting extremities, day to day or generation to generation. You get sort of references to forever. You also get God is high, he's lifted up, he's exalted, but you also have him bending down and lifting up the lowly in the psalm. And so you get some of that kind of movement in the psalm, and there seems to be an emphasis on the extremity, which would obviously sort of emphasize a difference between God and man, which we'll see a little bit more about that later. And you do get some repetition in this psalm, and it's a type of repetition where it's not identical words necessarily, although you do have some of the same word repeated a little bit, but it's not identical words. It's not even necessarily synonyms, but it's sort of related words, and it has the effect of just sort of piling up. And sometimes if we are maybe really excited about something, and we're looking for ways to maybe describe it to someone else or something, we'll be just grabbing all of these different adjectives that we can think of to try to describe this great thing, whatever that it is, and so that's sort of the effect that we see in this psalm with so many different related words. We have a lot of words that are related to praise, the speaking or the singing of praise, the lauding and extolling, all these things. We have different words that are related to greatness, and these are focused on God's greatness. We have words related to goodness, and that's God's goodness. We have different words that are related to powerful acts, like the things that God does, he upholds, he lifts up. And even we do have one statement in here that he destroys. He destroys the wicked. And so there's all kinds of different terms that are related to powerful acts in reference to God. Now, probably the most prominent feature is the fact that it is an acrostic psalm. So that means it's an alphabet acrostic. So we have the psalm where you have a verse. Each verse starts with a successive letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Now, you'll notice that there are only 21 verses, and there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And so there is one missing. So you do not have a verse for the letter Nun, which is the 14th letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It would occur sort of between verse 13 and 14 as you were reading through there. So they would sort of get renumbered from there to have 22 verses if it were following every letter. Now, I read a number of commentaries that seem to really make a huge deal about this. But here's the thing. It's actually not all that uncommon, even in an acrostic psalm like this. And you know, of course, the most elaborate one would be that of Psalm 119 that we looked at. But it's not uncommon for these acrostic psalms to not necessarily follow the alphabet exactly and not necessarily include all the letters. That's not uncommon. And an example of that is Psalms 25 and Psalm 34. So that's not uncommon. And then the other thing about when you look at this psalm and you look at this structure, actually leaving out one letter makes this psalm have three equal stanzas. And so I really, you know, the more I looked at it and thought about it, I don't really see it as a problem. There is, though it is quite late in terms of the Bible, but there is some historical references. Oh, there's a lost verse. And so some Bible versions today even have a verse in brackets or something in between 13 and 14 to start with noon. And basically, I think it takes another verse somewhere from the Psalms. And there, you know, there's slight historical evidence that verse should be there. But really, I don't believe it should, because the way we see the structure again, divides into those three even stanzas, and so I don't think it's accidental or something that's been lost. But it is again the last acrostic in the psalm, and so remember, when you have a psalm that's laid out with this kind of structure, and of course I know in English we don't see, you know, that structure, but when you have a psalm laid out this way, one of the effects of it is it's like saying this psalm is an A to Z praise of God. So it's thorough. It gives us the suggestion of completion. And some have also argued that it may have aided in memory, may have had some function in singing, but it certainly, the psalm, you can see that structure certainly is divided that way and divides very evenly that way. All right, so let's work our way through this psalm. We have 21 verses, so I'll go ahead and read this. I will extol thee, my God, O King, and I will bless thy name forever and ever. Every day will I bless thee, and I will praise thy name forever and ever. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise thy works to another, and shall declare thy mighty acts. I will speak of the glorious honor of thy majesty and of thy wondrous works. And men shall speak of the might of thy terrible acts, and I will declare thy greatness. They shall abundantly utter the memory of thy great goodness and shall sing of thy righteousness. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger and of great mercy. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. All thy works shall praise thee, O Lord, and thy saints shall bless thee. They shall speak of the glory of thy kingdom and talk of thy power, to make known to the sons of men his mighty acts and the glorious majesty of his kingdom. Thy kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and thy dominion endureth throughout all generations. The Lord upholdeth all that fall and raiseth up all those that be bowed down, the eyes of all that wait upon thee, and thou givest them their meat in due season. Thou openest thine hand and satisfiest the desires of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all his ways and holy in all his works. The Lord is nigh unto all them that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth. He will fulfill the desire of them that fear him. He will also hear their cry and will save them. The Lord preserveth all them that love him, but all the wicked will he destroy. My mouth shall speak the praise of the Lord, and let all flesh bless his holy name forever and ever. So verses 1 to 3 open the psalm. Open the psalm with a commitment to praise, a vow of praise, and you'll notice the future expressions as you go through the psalm. Now, the word for extol means to lift up or to make high. So it's an expression of praising in the sense of giving God praise that he is worthy of. It's not the idea of making God great, as if our praise is somehow making God greater than he would be without it, so to speak. But it's giving him the praise that is that he is worthy of, that is due to him. And you'll notice that there's direct address here to God as king. David confesses, "My God and king," or "O king," that he says. And then he speaks also of blessing the name of the Lord. Now, the word for bless we've encountered a number of times, and it does mean to bow before, to bow to. It's expressing the idea of worshiping and of praising. And notice the object, God's name, forever and ever. And so as we've been going through the Psalms, we've talked about this. We've looked at other places in the Old Testament as well. What is God's name? God's name is his covenant security. His name is what stands. It's the earnest of his covenant promises. So when you think about the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, and the Davidic covenants, you can see them all in the background of this psalm. The covenants that the Noahic covenant, which is essentially a covenant with mankind, with humankind. So God is not going to destroy this creation so that humankind is brought to an end. God's not going to do that. He's made a covenant promise. You come forward to the Abrahamic covenant, and God has chosen Abraham, and he's going to bless Abraham, and he's going to make him great, and he's going to make a nation of Abraham, and through them, he's going to bless all the nations of the earth. And then you come to the Davidic covenant, and God is going to bring his kingdom to the earth through the reign of David's son that is promised to him. And you can kind of see how. So all of these things are going together to work out of God's redemptive purpose for his creation. And so all of this is in the background of this psalm as you read these praises, because David is obviously envisioning prophetically all of these things being fulfilled, and so he's just sounding out this, again, this A to Z praise of God. And you see a lot of covenant terms, a lot of references that way as well. He expresses day after day, every day, there's an unending praise forever and ever. And the implication of sort of unending or endless praise of God is that God's king is on the earth forever, and David has everlasting rest, and he will never not be engaged in praising God. We also have this statement about the greatness of the Lord that opens up in verse 3 and describes his greatness as being unsearchable. And the idea of unsearchable is that you can't find the end. There's no way to measure it. There's no way to number it. There's no way to investigate and find out its fullness. And so one of the things that we thought, because there is a distinction here in several ways in this psalm between God and men, and again, we have that idea of God being high and men being low and the lowly and God bending and lifting up and all of that. And so there's another way that God's greatness and that distinction comes out, because his greatness cannot be found out. But when it comes to human beings, our greatness can be found out. And there's a number of examples that I thought about, and you could talk about, people with athletic ability in sports and what have you. You could talk about all the different kinds of endeavors. So I decided I would just pick on preachers. And so think about, so if you think about whoever that you might think of as, you know, this was the greatest preacher that I ever knew, and realize that greatness can be searched out, and it can be searched out in a couple of ways, because it's limited in the sense that, you know, there's weakness mixed in there somewhere. And then beyond that, if that preacher continues long enough, he will cease to be great. And you've had the experience of some preachers that as they have aged, and so their minds and their bodies begin to deteriorate. And I've personally seen quite a few who probably continued preaching for a long time after they should have stopped, because their greatness ended. And that's the case of all of us. I mean, no matter what it is, you might think of something that you're particularly good at, but if you live long enough, you won't be. You won't be good at that. You won't be a master of it. And so that's just sort of just thinking about how that God is again distinguished between his creation. So he's praised because his greatness, there's no end to it. There's no searching it out. There's no measuring it. There's no finding out the end of it. And you get to verses 4-7, and the praise opens up, and it sort of centers around the goodness of God. And so there will be praise from generation to generation. So essentially expressing the longevity of the praise. This is, and in this case, as we look throughout the psalm, we see that it's unending. It never stops. And his works and his acts are described in terms that indicate that they are done with great power. And when you think about this psalm and the praise that's going forth, and as you read through the different acts and attributes of God, you also you realize that there's sort of a focus of toward his creation, and you'll get some explicit statements in several verses later, but sort of toward his creation, this greatness of God. So in other words, it's not just praising God that these great works of power, but really for his redemptive acts and works toward his creation, and they are done with great power. We get reference to the majesty of God, referring usually to grandeur, to honor, to beauty, or almost like ornament. It's oftentimes we find these things together. Psalm 21 and verse 5, Psalm 45 and verse 3, Psalm 96 and verse 6, and you can just, if you go back and look at those psalms, you're gonna see there's sort of a kingdom emphasis with those psalms. We get reference to God's acts. We get references to remembrance and to singing praise. And it's interesting when you pair that with some of the laments. When you think about the laments, well, the laments are penned when the psalmist is in crisis. And so there's oftentimes, we've talked about how there's some sort of a time reference that this has been going on for a long time, or how long, you know, before, you know, you act and you do something about this, you deliver me, or whatever the case may be. They're in crisis. But here we have a vision of all crisis being past. And so God's mighty acts of deliverance are being remembered, and they're being sung about, and they're being, God is being praised, and there's sort of a feeling of celebration in the psalm. And so all danger and all crises, they're past. And then we get verses 8 and 9, which aren't exactly structurally centered in the psalm, but they're probably thematically central in the psalm, because they are so thematically important in particularly in the Old Testament as a whole. And so what you've got in verses 8 and 9 is you've got a reference and an echo of Exodus chapter 34 and verses 6 and 7. Now, this is when God showed his glory to Moses and declared his name when he passed in front of him. And so he, you know, have this riff, the Lord is gracious, full of compassion, slow to anger, and of great mercy, and so on. So if you recall, this happened, in Exodus 34, this happened right after the golden calf incident. And right after the golden calf incident, remember Moses, he throws the tablets down and he breaks them. And then Moses intercedes. He prays, he intercedes for Israel. He prays to God. And one of the things he asks is for God to show him his glory, which God does. So after the golden calf incident, after Moses' intercessory prayer, God passes in front of Moses, declares his name, and this is how God describes himself. This is what we got here in verses 8 and 9. This is the description that he gives. And essentially, what we get in this is that God is acting in remembrance of his promises to their fathers. And so what happens right after that? Well, right after that, God renews his covenant with Israel, referring to the old covenant, the Sinai covenant. He renews that covenant with Israel. Rather than destroying them, rather than just deleting them from the earth, he renews his covenant with them. He is gracious and he has mercy. Well, that word for mercy should be no surprise there in verse number 8. That word, that is chesed. And it is, when you read the context in Exodus, it is in covenant faithfulness. It is for the sake of God's name that he does not destroy Israel, even though they're at the base of the mountain worshiping a golden calf and all the things that are taking place. So this is the phrase that David sort of echoes. And again, it has to do with God's covenant faithfulness. We get reference to his tender mercies. And tender mercies here is a different word. It's not chesed. It's a word for compassion and for pity. And essentially, look at the expression, God's tenderness is over all of his works. So it's not just Israel that God is gracious to. It's not just Israel that God is compassionate to, that he is merciful to. There's a tenderness of God over all of his works and his acts to redeem and restore rather than completely destroy. Well, you say, well, you know, he certainly could have destroyed Israel there at Sinai, and he could. And he also could have destroyed this earth how many times? How many times? I mean, look at the wickedness in the world today. Look at the wickedness in the world down through history. How many times could God have destroyed this earth? But he hasn't. Why? Because that's not his purpose. And of course, he made a covenant promise with Noah and with mankind that he would not. So his tender mercies are truly over all of his works, all of his acts of creation. And then we get to verses 10 to 13, and this is where we get this central theme in this psalm, and this is all about the kingdom here in verses 10 to 13. And we see that word being repeated in his dominion and his kingdom. And the word for saints, the hasidim, refers to those that are in covenant relationship with Yahweh, those who have experienced his redemption. So in other words, this is a view of the future kingdom when all shall praise the Lord. The word for glory that is used there in the glory of thy kingdom in verse number 11, that is kavod. And we've talked about that term a number of times and how oftentimes that it is associated with reigning, with kingship, and with kingdom. And it's actually it's a word that occurs three times in this psalm, verses 5, 11, and 12. We get this reference to the sons of men, which is actually Adam that is there, the Bene Adam, the sons of Adam. He's going to make known. In other words, it's not just Israel that God is going to make his glory known to. And then we get the in verse 13, then we get this expression of the everlasting nature of the kingdom. And so what is being expressed there in verse 13 is actually very closely associated with Daniel's prophecy in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 14 and verse 27 in particular, these things being envisioned, having been fulfilled. Verses 14 to 16 then gives this even further universal expression in the sense that God is God to all. So all in his kingdom will receive his goodness. So there's a demonstrated compassion. There's a faithfulness and a goodness to all, and it's expressed with this imagery of feeding, like he's giving that daily bread. And all creation essentially is described here as being dependent on him, and it's obviously being supplied and provided for and sustained by him. Verses 17 to 21 that in this psalm give us this expression of praise forever. God is righteous and he is holy in all his ways and works. So this is truly proper praise. This is praise that recognizes that God always is and always does right. So there's no complaining against God. There's no questioning of God here. There is purely praise of God. Everything that God is and does is right and is always right. The real heart of praise for God in the Scripture. God is described in terms of nearness, and we've talked about some of these spatial references, and even though that God's so exalted and he's so high, his grandeur and all of these sort of things, it says that he's near. He is near to those that call on him, and we see further description that he's attentive, that he is faithful, that he saves those. And then we get this one statement here in verse 20 that he's going to preserve all them that love him, but he's going to destroy all the wicked. He's going to destroy all the wicked. And this might seem odd. It might even seem out of place in this psalm, but not when we understand David's prophetic vision in this psalm. Because even if you think back to some of the parables that we've looked at in recent time, you know, the kingdom is like this net that's going to be let down in the sea, and they're going to bring in this haul of fish, and they're going to separate good from the bad. Well, the wicked will not be allowed to enter into that kingdom. There will be a separation there. And so God says very plainly, he's going to preserve all them love him, but he's going to destroy all of the wicked. They will not enter into his kingdom. And then we get finally this concluding praise, let all flesh, I think that would essentially mean humankind, though it could be all living things, praise him, praise his name forever and ever. And again, we can see some of that which seems repeated in some of these later psalms that actually end this entire collection of the psalms. All right, so let's go to interpretation. So Psalm 145, even in its execution, it teaches this building up of praise of God. And in some ways, when you look at the psalm from beginning to end, you sort of read it in sequence. You can see there's a reflection here of God's redemptive purpose. So the psalm begins essentially with an individual voice that's praising God, proceeds through the faithful of Israel, those Hasidim, that would be praising God, and essentially ends with all living things praising endlessly. And again, you can see that sort of reflective of that timeline that God has in his redemptive purpose of how he's going to essentially redeem the creation. So God's faithfulness and goodness, as can be seen in this psalm, is not only to Israel, but it is to all nations, and it is to all of the earth. His goodness over all of his works. Now, and the wicked he will destroy, but all of those who love him and call on him, he is near to. And again, we see the roots of all those covenants in this psalm. So this psalm shows us by all these different terms and all these expressions, essentially that God's praise is just inexhaustible. Like we can't get to the end of it. And that's something that if we think about very much, I mean, it's difficult to comprehend because, you know, we just get tired. I mean, even things that we truly enjoy, you know, we can get tired and get to the point where, you know, I'm certainly not really enjoying this right now. You know, maybe after a while, I'll enjoy it again. But I mean, you know, so we're you know, in our human frailty, it's just hard for us to comprehend that. But God's praise is inexhaustible. There is no end to it. It's hard for us to even imagine, you know, well, what's that going to be like to be able to enjoy that. And what God accomplishes, essentially what we see in this psalm too, that what God accomplishes lasts forever. These are not just temporary little victories. As we look back over the past acts and works of God, whether the Red Sea or you know, the Exodus and delivering the people and all of these sort of things, whatever that it is, these are not just little sort of temporary victories, but what God actually accomplishes and does lasts forever. Well, the messianic hope of this psalm is seen through God's kingdom come to the earth with David's king. Certainly, we see the future aspect in this psalm. We see this future aspect to where even all flesh is going to be praising God, and it makes us think of places like Philippians chapter 2, verse number 9, after talking about Jesus being obedient unto death, says, "Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father." And so you know, Paul is obviously echoing from Old Testament prophecies in this part of Philippians, but that day is coming. And so this psalm is envisioning this time when all flesh is praising God. Every knee is bowing, every tongue is confessing. And then we can think about God's covenant promises to David. And one of the things that we've seen in the Psalms is that we've seen sort of a reference to God's universal kingdom. So God, you know, has a throne in the heavens and rules over the entirety of all of his creation, this entire universe that we don't even know the extents of, rules over it all. But that also God has set up the earth and has intended there to be a kingdom rule and reign on the earth. And we know that Adam failed at that, but the second Adam will not. And so these promises to David, and we see the sort of the complement of the universal kingdom of God and the earthly kingdom. And so just think about these promises that God spoke to David. First Chronicles chapter 17, verses 7 to 14. "Now therefore thus shalt thou say unto my servant David, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote, even from following the sheep, that thou shouldest be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with thee whithersoever thou hast walked, and have cut off all thine enemies from before thee, and have made thee a name like the name of the great men that are in the earth. Also I will ordain a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, and they shall dwell in their place, and shall be moved no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness waste them any more as at the beginning. And since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, moreover I will subdue all thine enemies. Furthermore, I tell thee that the Lord will build thee a house, and it shall come to pass when thy days be expired that thou must go to be with thy fathers, that I will raise up thy seed after thee, which shall be of thy sons, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build me a house, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son, and I will not take my mercy away from him as I took it from him that was before thee, but I will settle him in mine house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forevermore. And so David, in this psalm, is envisioning the fulfillment of these promises through his seed, that this will come to be. And so we get just a glimpse in this psalm, really, of what Revelation 20 will be like in many ways, the messianic kingdom. All right, let's go to application. I have two of these. Number one, understanding Psalm 145 helps us understand what will happen and helps us understand where we fit in. I mean, it's important, it's extremely important to understand the nation of Israel. It's very important. And it's important to understand what God's promises to them are. But it's also important to understand that Israel is God's chosen nation, promised to Abraham, and through them, God will bless all nations of the earth. So this psalm is quite universal in its scope. All who trust in him will be with him in his kingdom forever. And again, that's not just Israel, but through and out to all the nations of the earth. And so we read about this kingdom. Well, everyone that trusts in him has a place in this kingdom. Number two, understanding Psalm 145 helps us also understand our kinship with everyone who believes. And that's regardless of nation, people, tribes, tongues, all those sort of things. You know, you see those great visions in the book of Revelation where you have all of those peoples, all those different peoples before, you know, praising the Lamb. And that really is, you know, what we belong to, we that trust in the Lord. So it does help us, I believe, sort of understand that kinship that we have in this kingdom and this redeemed earth that we are going to share one day.